Mr. Rosenberg, you're right where you should be. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I initially had visions that I would be given actually 5 minutes at 12:25, and I appreciate your letting me hold off until 1 o'clock. May it please the court. I'd like to begin perhaps with Justice Pierre-Louis' observation as to the need for the board to have connected the date, first of all, its rejection of the presumptive three-year FET, and its extension for a 200, a setting of a 200-month FET to the standard, and the standard that the state has conceded applies is that in Berta, where the setting of the FET has to be related, connected to the board's burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence when the inmate will have where there's a likelihood of substantial, no longer a likelihood of substantial recidivism. And one thing about this record that is absolutely clear is that nowhere in the board's decisions is there any explanation of why the three-year presumption, the three-year presumptive FET, is not sufficient time for Mr. Cohen to come back to the board then to assess whether or not he has reduced that likelihood of recidivism below substantiality. And nowhere in the record is there a whisper as to why it will take a minimum of 200 months for Mr. Cohen to make those, to do so. And one way of looking at this is that if the board had chosen, say, a more proportional extension of, say, 6 months, it would be absolutely not a single word changed in its decisions other than substituting 6 months for 200 months, because nothing in the decisions speak to why 3 years is not enough time and why 200 months is the minimum time. Now, Justice Hoffman, you raised the issue of subjectivity in this decision. Of course, there is some subjectivity, but there is no more subjectivity really than the basic decision of parole denial, because it's essentially the same standard, except the board here has to tie in the likelihood of recidivism to some sort of timetable. And I think it's clear that it can't be a standardless decision. It can't be a situation where the board is just pulling figures out of thin air and it's just not subject to meaningful judicial review. There has to be some explanation of why 200 months, and we're not talking about 200 months as opposed to 199 months. There's some semblance of reasonableness that's going to be applied, but it just can't be standardless. Because if the choice is between pulling an FET out of thin air and having a standardless decision or not, then it strikes me that, as Mr. Welfel suggested, the better practice would be setting something that is more proportional to the presumptive FET and there's two ways of looking at it. Because we're only talking about when the inmate is coming back for a hearing. And why not have the person come back in 9 months? Because 9 months is an interesting figure, because the presumption that the board itself has put forward in the regulations is that it's 27 months, typically, that's presumed for anyone who has been convicted of the sort of time mm-hmm. that Mr. Cohen had been convicted. And if the board feels there are special circumstances, that you can increase it up another 9 months. So it would seem to make sense that if you're talking about, okay, the board has now felt that the 27 months is not sufficient time, the 9 months addition is not sufficient time, and it wants to tack on some other time, it should be some sort of proportional addition to it. And the Seton Hall Law Center brief does, I think, an excellent job of discussing that issue. And Chief Justice Ravner, you asked for the question as to whether or not we think there should be a standard that's less deferential to the board. In our brief, we talk about there being only extraordinary circumstances that the board must show if it's going beyond the presumption plus or minus the 9 months. And that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, I suggest looking at the Seton Hall Law Center's suggestion that proportionality be taken into consideration and added to the standard. With that, I'd just like to very briefly talk about a couple of factors that Mr. Wilfos did speak about today. One is lack of insight. Lack of insight seems to be the go-to justification right now for the board when it wants to tack on another decade or so to the presumption. And we see that in the Berta case, and we saw it in the Akali case. And there are a few things I want to say about it. First of all, and Mr. Welfel adverted to this, we don't know what is meant and what the board means by lack of insight. If they're asking Mr. Cohn to provide to the board some sort of sophisticated explanation of the underlying psychological, educational, environmental, cultural, emotional causes that led him to commit an act 30 years ago, I have to suggest that I'm not sure I could do that, and I'm not sure who could do that. And one way of looking at this is comparing this case with the Akali case. There, this court said that the board's findings as to lack of insight were threadbare, was the adjective that it used. And in that case, Mr. Akali was not able to admit to the facts surrounding the crime he had been convicted of. He did, as compared to Mr. Cohn, who has admitted to the facts, has expressed remorse, and has accepted complete responsibility for it. In the Akali case, Mr. Akali was a highly educated. I think he graduated college at the age of 19. He had worked for NASA, had worked for defense contractors, and he explained to the board that what he had learned during incarceration was to not break the law, to avoid criminal liability, to stay away from violence. And this court described those reasons, and I think I can quote it, as this is the sort of lessons one hopes that an inmate would learn from prison counseling programs. I think that's at 250 NJ at 464. In this case, Mr. Cohn has given the board much more. And Mr. Cohn, he didn't graduate from high school. He didn't have quite the education that others have had, but he was able, and there's really the letter that he wrote to the board on October 19th of 2019, goes in detail how he recognizes that, sure, when he was young, in his own word, he was dumb. But that wasn't his excuse for this. He understood he was looking for social acceptance, and that was wrong. He understood that he had a callous attitude towards his victim. He understood the ramifications of the crime that he had committed, that he had stolen the future from the victim. The board even acknowledged that Mr. Cohn had recognized and identified multiple contributing factors to his criminal activity, yet they found so-called lack of insight. What more could they want? And they don't say. The second point is that, unlike, as Mr. Welfold discussed, in Trantino, and the Berta court has asked for this also, there's absolutely no basis in this record or elsewhere where the board has explained the connection between so-called lack of insight and a risk of recidivism. And I think in Berta, and I think in Trantino, and in Akalai, the courts have said, even when you're dealing with someone who has not admitted the crime, we need some sort of basis in social science or behavioral science or elsewhere that connects that failure of admission to a risk of recidivism. And if that's so for situations where the crime is not admitted, it necessarily follows it's so where they're looking, the board is looking for insight as to why the crime was committed. And lastly, on this issue, nowhere again did the board indicate any connection between its suggestion that Mr. Cohn undertake some period of introspection and a timetable, and certainly not why it would take 17 years and 7 months for Mr. Cohn to have sufficient introspection so that as to be able to come back to the board again and demonstrate that. Lastly, I'd like to deal with two objective factors, Chief Justice Ravner, you asked about the LSIR, and that's one, and the second is the age crime curve.
I'm sorry, what was the first?
The LSIR, the tool, the risk assessment tool. As Mr. Welfo explained, Mr. Cohn scored a 24, that was 24 out of 54 on the LSIR. That's only 1 point, and that put him in the moderate range. That's only 1 point above the low to moderate range. And even in the moderate range, there was only a 28% chance of rearrest and a 17.1% chance of reconviction. Now, if you then look at the age crime curve, which is another universally recognized objective standard. In fact, I think that the proposition that as age increases, the risk of recidivism decreases. That variable is the single most accurate demographic or criminogenic variable. Mr. Cohn was 52 at the time of his parole hearing. He was 55 at the end of the 3-year presumptive FET. At age of 55, his chance of rearrest drops down to 22%. And reconviction down to 12%. And those, both of those figures, and as are the figures for the LSIR, are below what we would posit as the very high probability of recidivism that is implicit in the standard of substantial risk of recidivism. But equally important, nowhere did the board take into consideration explain how it took into consideration the LSIR score, the age crime curve, the interaction between the LSIR score and Mr. Cohn's age at age 55, or at any point between the end of 3 years and 17 years and 7 months when Mr. Cohn will be almost 70 years old, in terms of assessing whether or not that is a reasonable FET to set under the circumstances. Happy to take any questions from your honors.
Any questions, anyone?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Brent.
Justices and colleagues, I would like to succinctly address 3 points which I think are germane to our discussion here today. The first is deference. The second is the nature or the difficulty of the task providing a nexus between the 200 months and the assessment of any individual, but particularly Mr. Cohen. And finally, I would like to take a high risk and address Judge Geiger's commentary in Berta, because I think it's important, and I think we not be afraid, because I think fear is a problem. On deference, I wish to point out something that we all know, which is that deference is not an article of religious faith. It is an tool of interpretive methodology employed in the modern state where expertise is required in agencies to run and perform the functions of the state. And so that deference that we show is severely cabined by two things, that this expertise be employed in an effective means, a non-arbitrary way, and that due process be employed, especially since there is a liberty interest. It's obviously not the same liberty interest as an accused person, but there is a liberty interest, and we've addressed that in our brief. So here we have a circumstance in which, and this happens on a repeated basis, which I think we've been pointing out, there is deference being sought by an agency that, for example, if you go back to Mr. Rosenberg's comments, the two instruments administered by psychologists hired by the board are not commented upon or utilized. The LSIR is a very sophisticated instrument. It relates to offense conduct, but it cabins offense conduct consistent with the law and looks at recent developments. So those tools aren't employed. Is that arbitrary? Is that capricious? Because it's inconsistent with the law when we talk about the liberty interest that's involved. It is a use of unbridled discretion in this case. And let me make it clear that I agree with all the arguments made by my brother Wessel and Mr. Rosenberg, but occasionally I may depart a little bit. But I think it's important to note that in this case, as in many others that we've cited, the parole board has strayed well outside the realm of its proper conduct, and it is engaged in arbitrary conduct. And in this case, scientific instruments at its disposal were not used. The second point is the challenge. I believe, Justice Hoffman, you used the word impossible. I certainly wouldn't pick on a word you used any more than I want you to pick on my words. But I do think it's fair to say this is a serious matter. I've been practicing for 51 years, largely in our criminal courts, and I do not downplay the importance of the in-out decision, to put it crudely. It is vital, it is important, and it is something to be done with great concern, both for the liberty interests and for the interests of society. That said, we can't say this is impossible to perform in terms of them giving specific reasons, because the legislature and the administrative code have said they are. So the burden lies on the parole board and those who advocate for it to determine that there is a specific nexus between their findings and the FET, in this case, 200 months. Now, I agree, is 200 different than 199? Probably not. But there's a strong difference between the 27 or the 27 plus 9 and 200. And they have the burden of demonstrating that they have come up with a nexus between their findings, and thus ignoring their objective instruments is a serious problem. Nor have they, although they did delineate in their report a section justifying the FET, but you can call a kangaroo an elephant, but it won't have a trunk or floppy ears, because in fact, they don't talk about the reasons for the 200-month FET. And we're talking about months of potential liberty or not. And this is not 200 months till he gets paroled. It's 200 months till he gets a hearing, which is the gravamen of where our courts have found due process and fundamental fairness interests in the nature of the hearing and whether or not it is a meaningful opportunity to consider the factors that the statutes have placed before them. I venture with some temerity into Judge Geiger's comments, but they struck home with me. The first thing I said, hurrah, someone wearing a robe has acknowledged that with respect to parole board conduct, we are sometimes in a lawless land. Why else would Judge Geiger be saying in the context, in a concurrence, that in fact, we need to have articulable standards, because not the law, but the nature of parole board conduct in case after case, especially involving, and I'm going to say it, the cohort of the damned. These are men and women who have been convicted of the most serious offense that society has. But the legislature has said, not Brown, not Weffel, but the legislature has said there is a presumption at a certain point that they're to be considered for parole. And then there are certain rules governing the FETs. And so that group, as Dostoevsky and maybe de Tocqueville would say, is the metric by which we will be judged in our society. What do we do? So Judge Geiger has said, well, maybe we can get out there. And I was struck, as I always am, by a comment by Justice Patterson. You said, essentially,
I could go both ways, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
With great respect, as you know.
And we've had great conversations when my grandson was born. So she's always close to my heart, even though she never rules in my direction. So the question is, do we shy away from the possibility of de novo review? Not every day, not in every case. But it seems to me, not only would your opinion, in my view, have to clearly articulate the need to adherence to our statutory scheme and the administrative code in terms of the burdens and the failure of this parole board to act in a manner that is not arbitrarily, but at some point, I think this court may have to choose a case and say, we are willing in the right case to abandon deference because you haven't earned it. We're willing to say where arbitrariness occurs, we will in fact look at the underlying factors and see if there is a relationship that we can divine from what you say and the numbers you assign. Because the numbers, to those of us who toil in this vineyard, and in the last 10 years, I was here on a COLE, I represent Robert Reldon, so I've had to immerse myself in the parole universe and the cases we cite and Joe Russo's wonderful appendix, it's clear that the appellate division and the parole boards, the appellate division has tried, but parole boards haven't got the message. And it seems to me strong language, at the very least adhering to the standards of the statute and the code, but also suggesting that this court is not beyond saying, in this case, we will not defer. In this case, we will measure ourselves. And Justice Patterson, it might not be that you come up with your own FET. I recognize that's a bit too much, but you might very well be clear and critical of the FETs and the ways in which they are arrived.
Mr. Brown, is there something in between? Something between arbitrary and capricious.
Yes.
And de novo, which is not deferential.
Correct.
In your experience, what would you
I think,
and I know you're not advocating, you've placed your mark on it.
Right. And I haven't, as unlike the third base coach, I can't single to my client. But I do think it's possible. Certainly, if you take the literal language of Justice Guyver, he said there's not really adequate use of discretion. So there is an area where abuse of discretion could trigger a number of things, including other kinds of administrative review, a special master. I mean, there are other tools at the court's disposal because this isn't, ACDL is here, not because we know Mr. Cohen, but because the facts of his case trouble us and we think this is a systemic problem.
Would you suggest that that type of reviewing occur in cases in which it appears the parole board did not get the facts accurate?
That's very difficult, but I would say where you are, so for example, in Accoli, one of the questions asked by the parole board was, given the fact, Mr. Accoli, that you're an educated man, why would you engage in any kind of social activism with respect to issues of civil rights at the time you got involved in this issue of significant violence? And what Accoli tried to explain, but the board didn't draw on the expertise to learn is, I was raised by people who considered themselves race people. They said, you have an obligation to lift up the race. So now, does every parole board have to have the expertise to deal with that? No, but they ought to recognize when they don't. Does every parole board have the ability to assess facts? I think the issues raised by Mr. Weffel, how do we interpret, for example, I wouldn't say we quarrel with the facts of the issue of the fight or the housing refusal, but I do think there's a way in which that has to be put in context. How should that be weighed? Even if you don't do the weighing, how should it be weighed that a man who is speaking out about against gangs, assuming those are the facts, and those seem to be the facts, and therefore got involved in a contumely with others who beat him and then refused to go back to that prison, how should that be viewed? I don't think it's improper for this court, if it could fix the facts, to weigh in on that. I think there needs to be more involvement because it does not mean I have never thought that my adherence to the rule of law is because I believe the seven persons on this court are going to rule the way I want them to, but because I believe in the integrity of this body and its adherence to the rule of law. That is not inspired by the conduct of parole boards in case after case, especially in this cohort of the damned, which I call them. No, none of my colleagues approve of that language. But the truth is, that's who the legislature has said should be given parole, and they should certainly be given a hearing. I thank you. I probably went over a little my 5 minutes, and I thank you for your generosity.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Josephson.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rabner, Associate Justices. May it please the court. The issue in this case is a narrow one, whether the parole board's establishment of a 200-month extended future eligibility term in petitioner's case, which after credits applied is approximately 10 years and 4 months, was arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable. In light of the petitioner's extensive and repetitive criminal history and his serious and persistent infraction history while incarcerated. The board's decision should be affirmed because it was not arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable, and the record demonstrates that the board performed the proper legal analysis in establishing the FET. In affirming the board's decision, the appellate division agreed that the FET established in petitioner's case was not arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable because the board based its decision on sufficient credible evidence in the record, which it detailed in a comprehensive written decision, and because the board's decision was focused on the potential for recidivism as required by controlling law. In imposing the FET in petitioner's case, the record establishes and the appellate division agreed that the board considered all pertinent factors, that its decision was properly focused on the potential for recidivism, and that the board supplied sufficient reasoning for why it reached its conclusion that the FET imposed is appropriate for a petitioner, namely his extensive criminal and infraction histories, both of which reflect a lengthy history of violence and impulsiveness that he's failed to address while incarcerated. In establishing an extended FET in petitioner's case, the board followed the applicable law, including the law discussed in the Berta case, by focusing on the potential for recidivism and by explaining both why the presumptive FET in his case was clearly inappropriate and why the FET that was actually imposed was necessary and appropriate. As reflected in the board panel's narrative notice of decision, the board focused on Cowan's responses to their questions at the hearing, which demonstrated a lack of insight or understanding into his criminal behavior, and also upon his serious and persistent commission of institutional infractions, including a violent infraction for fighting less than 2 years prior to his parole eligibility date, all of which demonstrated that he required a significant period of additional time in prison to address the underlying reasons for and motivations for his criminal and institutional behavior. Finally, as the board argued in its supplemental brief, this case is much more analogous to the McGowan case than to Berta. In McGowan, the appellate division affirmed the board's establishment of a 30-year FET, which was also reduced by credits, notwithstanding the fact that McGowan was infraction-free for his entire incarceration. In doing so, the court largely relied upon McGowan's lack of insight into his crimes and found that the board, in setting the 30-year FET, had focused its attention squarely on the likelihood of recidivism. This is exactly what the board did here and why the board's decision in this case should be affirmed. I'm happy to answer any questions.
What was the standard? What was the benchmark that the board used in affixing a 200-month FET as opposed to 100, 150, or 250? What principle did the board tether its particular number to?
Well, again, the standard for an extended FET is clearly inappropriate, or that it's he's demonstrated a lack of satisfactory progress and reduced the likelihood of criminal behavior. But in terms, I don't believe the board is required to explain why it imposed one particular FET over another FET in terms of the length. But they certainly are required.
I'm not asking just to clarify if I confused you. I'm not asking whether they compared it to another number.
Right.
I'm asking what principle did they follow in order to come up with that number, which arguably could apply to many other numbers.
Well, I guess it's their expertise in deciding these cases.
Standard that they used in applying their expertise was what?
Well, their standard was that he based again upon his criminal history, his infraction history, his statements to the board, all of which reflected that he needed a significant period of time to address these issues and to overcome the substantial likelihood he would commit a crime. They did not specifically explain why they chose 200 as a number. I can't answer that question.
But where does that mean the decision? We're into the decision. You argue that the board followed applicable law by focusing on recidivism. Where in the three board panel's decision does the panel focus on recidivism and tie that to their findings with regard to his lack of insight and his infraction history? Where is it that the board mentions recidivism or potential reoffense at all?
Well, they don't use the term recidivism, but in those last 2 pages of their three-member panel decision, where they give the reasons for imposing it, and I would point out that the the appellate division, noted that they basically indicated that he needed this additional time to address the reasons. Here it is. Well, the appellate division, the appellate division noted the board's findings that the FET was necessary to allow petitioner to achieve a better understanding of the causes and motivations of his criminal and institutional behavior.
I'm asking where in the decision, I know you're reading, seems like you're reading from the appellate division decision, where in the three member panel's decision is that found? Where can I find the panel explaining why, based on their findings with regard to Cohen's infraction history, his lack of insight, why it is that those findings are connected to his likelihood of reoffense?
Well, again, I would point again to the three-member panel's entire decision goes through all the relevant factors. Again, they're supposed to consider the same factors they consider in deciding whether to grant or deny parole. And they go through the factors, which includes his criminal history, and they talk about his insufficient problem resolution and his statements supporting that. But other than that, they don't specifically talk about or use the term recidivism, but that, I think, explains their decision for imposing the FET that they did. Other than that, there isn't anything else to point to other than the actual decision and what they...
Do you agree in the Administrative Code 3.21C, 3.21D, that in order for the three board panel to establish an FET beyond the scheduled term, beyond the additional 9 months, the standard in that administrative code section is that the future eligibility date would be clearly inappropriate due to the inmate's lack of satisfactory progress in reducing the likelihood of future criminal behavior. Do you agree that that is the standard for going above and beyond the scheduled term and the additional 9 months?
Yes.
But you agree, or you've conceded, that the decision says nothing about
that.
Well,
no. Well, it doesn't. I can see that it doesn't use the term recidivism, but it certainly talks about, justifies the finding that he hasn't made satisfactory progress. And that, the reference to the infractions, the reference to his comments at the hearing reflecting his lack of insight, that's all explained in detail in the decision supporting that finding, the finding of a lack of satisfactory progress in overcoming criminal behavior.
I don't think that's right, Counselor. I have to be honest with you. I'm going to pick up right where Justice Pierre-Louis was, because I had the exact same question. The subsection that Justice Pierre-Louis referred to has to do with progress, right? It's a trending. It's a progression, right? It has a start point. It has an end point. There's a trend line. There's movement, right? And if you look at the part of the decision that discusses the infractions, it just says his commission of 21 infractions. Now, we know that 17 of those infractions were in the early 10 years, and 4 of them were in the later 10 years. So if you're talking about the concept of progress, you're talking about the fact that, is there improvement? So if there's improvement or not, you would naturally expect to see a discussion or an analysis of, well, what was he like in the earlier time, and what was he like in the later time? How is he trending? Is there satisfactory progress? But there's not that discussion here. There's simply the listing of 21 convictions or 21 offenses, as if all 21 could have occurred the first year and none could have occurred the next 20 years. That's not a discussion of progress.
Well, just one brief correction. I think in the last 10 years, from 2010 to 2020, I believe he committed a total of 7 infractions and 5 were serious. So just so that, there was a few more than 4. But again, they do talk about, and they're most concerned about the recent infractions, because, that's when they're considering for parole. And one involved, fighting, which was consistent with his, offense record, which included numerous violent offenses. So they do, in fact, talk about that most recent infraction. I would point out, this is, by comparison's sake, in Berta, he had no infractions during his previous 20 years, which the court deemed showed that he basically showed substantial improvement in his behavior. That's in Mr. Cohen's record is quite different. Again, he basically started committing infractions from the time he started his sentence in 93, and was and basically was committing them all the way up until right before he was eligible for parole. So there was a pattern there, and I think the board provided sufficient discussion of why that was a concern in setting the FET.
The vast majority of those offenses occurred earlier in his term. How is it then that that doesn't show progress? And where in this does it discuss progress? Does it discuss change? Does it discuss that dynamic trend?
Well, again, I think, he committed a serious offense involving narcotics in 2016. He committed the fighting offense in 2018. He committed an offense subsequent to that. So I think it's arguable that, in fact, he showed progress in terms of his institutional behavior.
Setting aside how the board applied the standard in this case, the Chief Justice was asking you several questions about what the standard should be. Just to make it more concrete, I want to understand your position. Your adversary says that there are three pieces to a standard. One, there's a presumption that the board will impose an FET within the schedule. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Two, the board must overcome the presumption of the scheduled FET by demonstrating that the inmate will still pose a substantial likelihood of committing a crime by the end of the scheduled FET. Do you agree with that?
That's not what the regulations or the case law actually say. In petitioner's brief, they talked about the FET has to correlate with the period of time where he will be basically below substantial likelihood. But that language is not used anywhere in the statute or regulations.
So I'm looking at the statute, the 1979 Parole Act, and it says an adult inmate shall be released on parole at the time of parole eligibility unless information supplied indicates by a preponderance of the evidence that there is a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime under the laws of this state if released on parole at such time. So your adversary's point is if the person must be released, as far as I understand it, unless there is a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime under the laws of this state, then the FET can only be as long as is necessary to ensure that there is not a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime under the laws of this state.
Well, but that's a decision that would be made at the subsequent hearing to determine whether he has satisfied that standard after completing the FET. When the board sets the FET, I think obviously they're hoping and that he'll gain that, he'll do whatever is necessary to satisfy the parole standard the next time he comes up.
But I think your adversary's point is because the overall standard for granting parole is that parole must be granted unless there is a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime under the laws of this state, that, for example, if the board were to say, no, we are going to not release the person on parole and we're going to have an FET, for example, of 200 months because we think that, forget about substantial likelihood, we're going to apply a different standard. We're going to say that there is a 1% chance that the inmate will commit a crime if released, and we don't think that a 1% chance is small enough, and therefore we're going to set an FET of 200 months. Would you agree that the board would be able to do that?
I don't know if I quite understand your question.
I think your adversary is arguing that the statutory standard of substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime must determine, the board must be bound by that, both in terms of release and then also in terms of setting an FET. And they could not, for example, say, you know, we disagree with that. We think that a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime is actually not protective enough of the public, and we're not going to release you because there's even a 1% chance that you might commit a crime. You agree the board would not be able to do that, correct?
Right. But again,
could they do that in setting an FET? That's my question.
Well,
or
I guess
FET the same as the substantive standard?
In setting the FET, they're establishing a period of time, whether it's it's not the presumptive, we're only talking about extended FETs, that they believe it's necessary, that he's necessary for the inmate to essentially become, parole, to achieve parole. What I'm having difficulty is, okay, at the end of the FET, he's not being released. He's going to have another hearing to determine whether there's a substantial likelihood at that time that he's going to commit another crime. And the process starts over at the end of the first FET.
I agree with you. It just seems odd, for example, that the parole board would have to release a person if there is not a substantial likelihood that they will commit a crime, but then could impose, for example, a 40-year FET because they say, we think this substantial likelihood standard is nonsense and we're not going to have him come back for another hearing until there's a 0% chance that he will commit another crime. That is what I understand your adversary's point to be, that the substantive standard impacts the FET because the substantive standard is what is determining when a person must be released versus when they can be kept in prison once they hit the parole eligibility date.
Well, but I guess the point is that, serving the FET, I'm not quite sure how to respond to your question, to be honest.
But do you agree that the FET, the FET is tied into the denial of parole as an initial matter, correct? Under the 1979 right. Parole Act, an inmate shall be released unless information supplied through a report or what have you indicates by a preponderance of the evidence that there is a substantial likelihood that the inmate will commit a crime, right?
Right.
If that denial happens, an FET must be imposed.
Right.
We have the scheduled FET, but the parole board can go over and above that scheduled FET if the scheduled FET is inappropriate because the inmate who was denied parole because there is an indication that there's a substantial likelihood that they will commit a crime, that inmate needs a longer FET because the scheduled FET is inappropriate to allow that inmate to progress to reducing the likelihood of criminal conduct and criminal behavior. So there's an interplay between that standard in the statute and the standard in going above and beyond the FET. Do you understand?
Yes, but I think there's an important point to be made here. The presumptive FET is it's based on one of two factors, the nature of the crime or the length of sentence. These are objective factors. The parole board, in setting the FET, then has to make a determination whether there are other factors involved in a case like here, which would basically, which they would rely upon to determine that a longer period is needed before he becomes, suitable for parole.
Because that period is needed to address reducing the likelihood of engaging in future criminal behavior. And I think what many of us are questioning is the fact that the parole board does not seem to be making that nexus, making that connection between their findings and the factors that they are reviewing and finding with regard to an inmate seeking parole and the determination that an extended term here from 27 months, a little over 2 years, to 200 months, over 16 and a half years, is needed to address the reducing the likelihood of criminal behavior. So I think we all understand that the parole board is looking at factors, but how are those factors connected to the standard that is in the administrative code? The parole board doesn't tell us that there's a connection, that we already had that discussion. There's nothing in this right. decision that says that.
But I would just note Justice Hoffman's point that it's virtually impossible, as he said, to tie the reasons to a particular number. and also the fact that, of course, parole board decisions, they're obviously, these are individualized assessments, and they are, as the terminology is, they're inherently imprecise.
But you agree that there is a presumption. I think you agreed with Justice Wiener-Apter that there is a presumption that the schedule, if FET, would be imposed. So that's the starting point.
Assuming that there aren't these other factors that justify a longer FET.
That is the starting point, yes. Correct? So it's based not virtually or, impossible right. with regard to where the starting point is based on the offense of conviction.
That's the starting point, yes.
Counsel, one of the things that the parole board shall consider, and that's 311B23, is the objective risk assessment instrument. Here, Dr. Mukowski found a moderate risk for recidivism. Did the board address that finding in any way? And does it support a 200-month FET?
In and of itself, no. And it was noted as an aggravating factor on their checklist decision, that the two-member panel's checklist decision, I believe three-member panel's as well. And they did note it as a factor. I would simply say that it's apparent they didn't... they gave it some weight, but that these other factors that they cite were given significant more weight. But there was no additional discussion about their reliance on the LSIR in rendering their decision.
What weight in general should be given? This is an objective measure.
Right.
Arguably by definition, as opposed to more subjective ones. And here it was just a checkbox.
It depends on the case. It depends on the factors that are relevant to each case. In terms of, again, it would be on a case by case basis, depending on what factors apply to a particular case. Why they didn't say more, I can't tell you.
Counsel, is it your position that the purpose of the decision is to communicate to the inmate that during this period of FET, that their behavior should conform based on the indications that they've made as to the reasons why they're going to be held until the next review date?
Yes. And then, in fact, they did indicate on their decision, they were suggested that he remain infraction free.
Right.
And I just think this would, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. But if that's the case, could you explain what you must conduct an introspection to understand the emotional and psychological dynamics of your criminal thinking? What does that statement mean? And how is an inmate supposed to interpret that during the next 200 months, they must conform their behavior based on that indication? Like, how does that communicate what you're saying it should?
Well, in this particular case, when Mr. Cohen had his hearing, and they asked him about his crimes and what prompted him to commit his crimes. Again, he simply referred to that he was young and dumb and that he was trying to fit in with his friends. And that's pretty much all he had to say. The board's, then position or their interpretation of that is, well, there's got to be more to it than just the superficial reasons for being young and dumb, that there was something about yourself that you haven't addressed or acknowledged that would prompt you to commit these kinds of crimes, where he shot somebody during the course of a robbery, and then he hit a corrections officer over the head with a pipe during a violent escape. And being young and dumb simply doesn't explain someone's behavior.
Assuming all of that is true, how does that statement in the decision, because there's no other communication with the inmate besides this decision, correct? There's no additional pamphlets or direction from the parole board given to the inmate. This is it, right?
Well, this is it, but there's certainly plenty of opportunities within the prison to take programs, to get counseling.
But that's not the parole board explaining that to the inmate.
Correct.
Okay. So given that this is the only indication of that, and assuming everything you said was true, how does the 200-month FET explain why that is going to be able to be done during that period of time? How is that possible?
Well, I guess in setting the FET, what the board is basically communicating or signaling is that he needs a substantial period of time to address these issues that they discuss in their decision about, you know, his lack of understanding and insight, however you want to put it.
Based on what metric? How do they pull the number 200 months to suggest that that'll be enough time, perhaps, hopefully, that when he comes back before the parole board, he will suddenly have a better understanding of his childhood and his entire adult life and how he corresponds and reacts to other people with regard to crime?
You know, again, they didn't specifically explain why they arrived at, and not to raise this again, but it actually is, it's 10 years is what we're talking about with the credits applied. It's 10 years, which is a significant period. But that's what the based, again, on their experience and their expertise, that's what the board felt that he needed, you know, this significant period of time to address these issues. How they arrived at 200, they don't specifically explain that in their decision.
Shouldn't we know that?
Well, I think, you know, with board's decisions are obviously entitled to substantial deference for, you know, a good reason in that these are, again, difficult decisions. They're inherently imprecise. Certainly you can compare it to other cases, I guess.
You're telling us to rely on their expertise in order to defer to the agency's judgment here, but you're not really explaining what the expertise has to back that up. If you had that answer, then perhaps we would say the expertise is explained and justified, but nobody's given us that answer.
Well, again, I can only point to that this is what the parole board does. This is their function to determine, you know, parole, whether someone should be granted parole, and if not, to determine how long they should they need to be before they become suitable for parole. I don't really, other than that, I can't really point to anything else on the record.
But I'm going to come back to something sure. We spoke about earlier. Isn't it troubling then that the one true expert with education and training and experience and a validated risk assessment tool was essentially just given lip service in the process?
I don't know if it was necessarily given lip service, but I can't speak to why there was no additional discussion. Presumably, obviously, it's a relevant factor. I can't really, the board doesn't explain why that's not, referenced other than on the checklist decision.
So there's a lot that you've I think conceded that the board doesn't explain. Does that make their decision arbitrary?
I don't think so. Based on the factors they relied upon, which are highly relevant, I think, you know, his infraction history, his criminal history, which spans, you know, a very long period of time and includes a lot of violent acts, I think justifies their decision.
Do you really think anybody could read that report and get to the end and say, oh, they must be around 200?
I guess if you read a lot of parole decisions, maybe. But other than someone else, a lay person, I they'd have to have a pretty substantial and significant understanding of parole decisions.
You agree that subsection F about the 12-month and 18-month reviews does not apply in this case, correct?
Correct.
And it did apply, in McGowan, correct?
It did in McGowan. I would just point out, though, that the annual reviews are entirely discretionary. The board is not required to reduce an F. They still do some. They're not required to reduce the FET. It's based on whether the inmates made any progress. In my limited experience, I've had a couple of appeals. Typically, they would reduce the FET by 2 or 3 months at most.
They are required to consider whether they should reduce the FET, correct?
Under that regulation, yes.
So if we do not affirm like you're requesting that we do, there are only two other options, reverse or remand. I'm thinking that you would suggest we remand, correct? And if so, for what?
I would certainly prefer a remand for the board to reconsider the FET decision in light of the record in this case.
And in directing the remand proceedings, would you be suggesting that we include that the parole board needs to explain, not only in this case, but in general, how they arrive at the number of months in connection with the goal of reducing the inmate's recidivism, right?
Well, I know the parole board would certainly like to retain as much discretion as possible.
I would at least have to explain the connection.
If the court does that, then certainly the board would be required to do that. And if they don't, then clearly that would be an arbitrary decision. But I can't, reject that out of hand now.
We're talking about a very difficult question, and that is predicting future behavior. You and your colleagues have both stressed to us that the FET date is not a release date. It's just a date for the next opportunity to consider this with care.
Right.
With that in mind, why are we seeing such lengthy FET dates as this case presents? Why not schedule a hearing, which may result in an additional extension in a much closer period of time to the actual hearing?
Well, the board could certainly do that. I do think there are certain cases where the record is reflecting someone who really has made no progress in their, achieving rehabilitation or overcoming substantial likelihood, where, a somewhat lengthy, 10 years or whatever, 5 years would be appropriate.
Is this such a case where there's been no progress, using your words?
Well, I think his progress, based on his record, I think is pretty minimal when he's still committing infractions right up, less than 2 years before his parole eligibility date. And he's, demonstrating to the board, I think, that he doesn't really understand the violence component to his crimes. That was obviously highly to the board that found that to be troubling. And, that's how they arrived at their decision.
Any questions, anyone?
For people that are in prison for decades, what is the percentage of individuals that have no to little infractions?
I think it's pretty small. The law has changed somewhat recently, though, and if as in Berta, if their infractions are remote, the board is not to consider them. That's not what we have here, though. I mean, in Berta, his last infraction was 20 years before his parole eligibility date. So the appellate division at least has to basically indicate to the board that you can't consider remote infractions. But there are cases where people are infraction free for their entire incarceration. I just want to make one brief point, and at the end of his argument, counsel noted that Mr. Cohen hasn't had any infractions in the last 5.5 years. Obviously, that has no relevance and should not be considered by the court in this case. And frankly, I don't know why it was brought up. Obviously, it's a relevant fact at his next hearing, but that should not be before the court in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Back. Well, brief rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to really focus on just one point, and this has to do with the difficulty of predicting or explaining a particular number. And so this, this question of the crystal ball argument, the difficulty of predicting when you will meet the standard for parole over a lengthy time, I actually think cuts against imposing lengthy FETs, like the 200-month FET in this case. And I think rather than framing it in terms of we have to predict now when you will meet it in the future, it should be framed as, okay, here's what your risk is. Here's why today you still present a substantial likelihood of committing a new crime. And then to Justice Hoffman's point about the word progress, right? Here's what you need to do. Here's why you're a risk. Here's what you need to do. And here's how long that will take. And that sort of framing will ground the number in an explanation. And if the board can't say what you're supposed to do over 200 months or 60 months or 100 months, why it's going to take that long, then the board can't impose an FET of that length. And, you know, we may sit here and say it seems very hard to think what they would say somebody should be doing over that period, that lengthy period of time. And in that case, we would just say, well, then they can't, if they can't justify it, then they can't impose it. If the court has further questions.
I just have one, if you don't mind. On that last, for the progress period, do you think that the factors that are looked at for the release should be viewed slightly differently in terms of setting the fact, because the concept of progress should play a role?
I haven't, just to be frank, I haven't thought about it before Your Honor just asked the question. I think the factors, it's the same factors in the code that are relevant to the release decision as are relevant to the FET. I do like Your Honor's focus on progress. To me, that seems to suggest a focus on what the inmate should be doing. But the factors themselves still need to be considered with respect to how they relate to a substantial likelihood of recidivism.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.